Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season really is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here, as always, with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hi, Katie.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
This week, the Tribeca Film Festival is still ongoing downtown Manhattan, not very far from our office, in fact. And we've welcomed IndieWire's film editor, Kate Erbland, to give us the rundown of this year's festival with a couple of titles that might just be getting Oscar buzz and a little bit of discussion of what Tribeca is. It's its 15th anniversary, and in some ways, it's still figuring that out. From there, we discuss The Huntsman Winter's War, which is a movie opening this week that will not get any Oscar buzz, I'm willing to predict. But it does include two Oscar nominees and costumes worthy of maybe every Oscar available, and we should have a kind of interesting possible fight about that. But first, I look at the weekend Oscar news, which finally brought us the Cannes lineup. We've been, Richard in particular, has been impatiently waiting to figure out what the heck's going to be over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Richard, you'll be going for the third time this year. Mike, you'll be out there as well, but very briefly, it seems.
Yes.
So, Richard, what are we excited about for Cannes?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot to be excited about. I think, you know, the thing that people are upset about, understandably, is that there are very few women represented, female directors, which is too bad.
It's about the same number as last year, though.
Yeah, but it's always regression. It's like three. I mean, out of, you know, 20-something. It's pretty sad. But that, you know, so if we can put that aside for right now, there is a lot to be excited about in that this year, it seems to be this kind of battle of the auteurs, as a phrase I've heard used, because you have these a ton of Cannes kind of mainstays of the last 20 years. Olivier Assayas, Xavier Dolan, Park Chan-wook, the Dardenne brothers. I mean, it's just this whole kind of lineup of people who've either won the Palme d'Or or come close and all bringing new films to the table. And then, you know, a bunch of other directors who have done interesting things at Cannes before, like Jeff Nichols and Andrea Arnold.
Jeff Nichols, who made this year's Midnight Special, which we talked about, and has another movie coming out.
Yeah, this Loving, is the second is movie fall, which, this year, which is wild. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about the lineup, and I was trying to sort of distill that into things that I'm most excited about if I had to pick like three titles, just because I don't want to overwhelm people with, you know, movies that they won't see for a long time, probably. I would say that the top three of interest for me are the Olivier Assayas movie, Personal Shopper. It's his second project with Kristen Stewart. 2 years ago at Cannes, they had Clouds of Sils Maria, and that ended up winning Kristen Stewart a César Acting Award, which she was the first American woman to ever win that award. Mm-hmm. It was my number two favorite movie of last year, so I'm really curious to see what they do again together.
So it's kind of a ghost story.
That's
the way
what
it's
I've
described.
Heard. It's a ghost story. I don't know much beyond it past that, so I'm really looking forward to that. I'm very curious about American Honey, which is the Andrea Arnold film. It stars Shia LaBeouf. It's a few years ago, Andrea Arnold made this movie called Fish Tank with Michael Fassbender as a sort of supporting role that was fantastic and really sort of took Cannes by storm and by surprise.
And right before Michael Fassbender really emerged. It was kind of his last, like, oh, I'm just an indie actor.
Right, movie. Exactly. And so I really like, that's a really strong film. And this is her first set in the United States, and it's said to be sort of a road movie. So I'm just really, and that's one of the titles that I feel like when people started predicting what would be in the Cannes slate this year, that movie has been in the mix since the very
beginning.
I'm always
amazed that anyone can predict.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then I think the third film that I would list, I mean, The Loving is really interesting. There's a Paul Verhoeven movie with Isabelle Huppert that I'm curious about. But I would have to say, just maybe personal bias, Xavier Dolan, who's sort of the wunderkind of Cannes. I mean, this is his sixth time going to the festival, and he's not even 30.
Ugh.
And he's this very handsome Quebecois, you know, blah, blah, blah.
We're not jealous of him at all.
No, no. I didn't introduce myself to him at a party 2 years ago, and he was not very nice to me. No, that didn't happen. He has a movie coming out called It's Only the End of the World with Marion Cotillard and Gaspard Ulliez and Vincent Cassel. So it's this very like French, it's like Ocean's 11 of France, because it's all these huge French movie stars mm-hmm. in this one movie that's about a sort of estranged son returning home to tell his family that he's dying. So it sounds kind of intense, but it's interesting because he sort of snuck this movie in, Dolan did, right before he makes his big English language star-studded feature that's going to be out, I think, next year with Jessica Chastain and Kathy Bates mm-hmm. and Susan Sarandon. So this is kind of not his last, you know, French film, I don't think by any means, but it's one of those kind of like little secret side projects that just happened to arrive first.
And he also directed the Adele video recently. Like he's
he
kind
did.
Of like
the Hello video. Yeah,
he is like mm-hmm. really like on the cusp of being like a yeah. household name and, for directors.
And 2 years ago, his film Mommy was my favorite thing at Cannes. It's just mm-hmm. a very powerful, you know, really exquisitely, interestingly made movie. So I'd say those are the three that I'm most excited about. But there's really a ton this year. It's
Marion Cotillard. That if you want to get your film into Cannes. That's a smart move, right?
She's
just cast
two.
Her. That's mm-hmm. big.
Yeah, yeah. They love her, and she's always good for a kind of weird quote about the moon landing or something. So,
how
yeah.
about George Miller as the head of the jury? Is that?
I think that's really cool. Yeah. I mean, I think that you know, we they haven't revealed who the rest of the jury is, but I know
hopefully Charlize Theron, Tom Hardy, mm-hmm.
right? Just
war
like,
boy
you know,
or two,
war, a couple
yeah.
war boys.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Zoe Kravitz,
Riley you know, Keough.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There you go. I don't know. You know, I don't. You really don't know how that is going to affect things like what the taste level is going to be. You know, I think that. You know, the Coen brothers were the jurors last year, the head jurors together, yep. and they ended up awarding the Palme d'Or to this movie Dipan, which is this kind of, you know, gritty French kind of crime thriller about a Sri Lankan immigrant. And it didn't really seem to be in the Coen brothers' wheelhouse exactly. It wasn't exactly their style, but something spoke to them. But, you know, I heard more interestingly kind of down the line in terms of when they award best acting prizes at Cannes that last year, and Xavier Dolan was on the jury as well, that there was some conflict there. So that's always yes. interesting to hear about at the end of the festival. I heard there was a walkout threatened by one member. And
was it last year that they split an award, or was that Spielberg 2 years ago?
That was, so last year it was the best actress. It was
okay.
Rooney Mara and an actress from a French film whose name I can't remember.
See, I love how French yep. it is, too, that they can just be like, there's two awards this year.
Yeah, yeah. No, they bend the rules.
We cannot agree.
But with George Miller, I would hope to see some kind of idiosyncratic, you know, weird stuff happen, you know, because mm-hmm. he's yeah. that kind of guy. And, you know, a lot of the rest of the jury, I mean, who knows? But, you know, I think hopefully he'll wield a sort of interesting influence over them.
And what is Cannes for, if not kind of celebrating people who are going to chase their own weird vision in making the movie,
yeah.
which is exactly what George
Absolutely.
Miller did in making Mad Max.
Yeah, it's such an auteur. And Mad Max opened the festival last year, so
yep.
or was a special screening, rather, in the same way Money Monster is going to be.
And Spielberg's The BFG is going to be there as a special screening,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. which is his reunion with Mark Rylance, the animated movie. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good mix of, you know, your very sort of esoteric art house. You know, I'm excited to see, you know, there are two Romanian film directors whose oeuvres are really lauded, but I'm not that familiar with. So I'm excited to see that. But I'm also on the complete opposite side, excited to see the BFG, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
sure.
It'll be a fun. They do a good job of balancing the, you know, big Hollywood with, you know, the sort of international cinema that they're known for.
So last year, Mad Max kind of came out of Cannes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
then 2 years ago, Foxcatcher came out of Cannes.
Carol was out of Cannes last year.
Carol was out of yep. Cannes last
yeah.
year.
Yep.
So the BFG is a likely animated nominee.
I'm not sure
right?
if it's fully animated or not. I know Mike Rylance's character is animated, but I can't remember if the whole movie's animated.
I think.
Would it matter?
I think it's not.
Sorry,
would it help?
Would it help? Would it help? Sorry.
For just spies references, really. Keep going.
I mean, it could be. And I think that, you know, obviously, Rylance, who plays the BFG, has, you know, the Oscar weight behind him right now. And
and
his collaboration with Spielberg continues apace with this. And, you know, it's a big platform for that movie, certainly. And it's respectable.
Yeah.
Do you know? I mean, they did last year, the special screenings were Mad Max and Inside Out, which people loved.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people's,
yeah.
you know, top 10 of the year.
But also like Kung Fu Panda 2, maybe the first Kung Fu Panda.
Right. So it,
there,
you know, so. And the Expendables 3, I believe, a few years ago. So it's it varies, but you know, I think that if just based on last year, I think that we should expect big things from the BFG.
And also for those of us staying home, even if we don't get to see these movies for a while, the Cannes red carpet is always incredible, and yep. there will be lots of photos on VanityFair.com of the insane things that like various Russian TV personalities are wearing on the red carpet.
Absolutely. Last week, I was sort of cynically saying that, you know, just really fingers crossed that there were a lot of big name movie stars who were going to be at the thing, because that really helps us in terms of photos. And hey, it panned out. There's a lot of people.
Yeah, people wear amazing things in Cannes, so it's a fun game to watch from home.
By the way,
yeah.
just going to throw this out there. There's a Woody Allen Cafe Society out of competition. Yeah. Yeah. Just thinking awards wise, you know, sometimes the competition ones are very sort of Euro or arty. But also the Nice Guys. Like, is there any chance the Nice Guys?
I could see that being a screenplay thing.
Yeah, I
could see that. I mean, people like Shane Black. He has a good narrative of kind of burning out after some success in the late 80s, early 90s, and then returning with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and then doing Iron Man 3. And so he's kind of returning to a smaller scale, but sort of very like, sort of a tourist take on a kind of buddy cop movie. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Mike. I think that has potential, definitely, and shouldn't be ignored. And I think, you know, they chose it to be there because its release date is somewhat soon after, but also, I mean, they chose it to be there for, you know, other reasons that have yet to be seen. But,
Ryan Gosling wearing linen on the.
Yeah, I was going to say. I can think of one reason. Yeah, Ryan Gosling at the festival.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you're right. I think that, you know, Shane Black is someone that we should not count out yet.
No, don't count out anyone.
I'm not.
Really briefly, elsewhere, there was the first trailer for The Birth of a Nation, which is the movie that we talked about coming out of Sundance, directed by Nate Parker, about Nat Turner's slave revolt. Richard, you've seen it. Mike, you and I hadn't. So did seeing this trailer teach you anything, did you think, about what we should expect from this movie?
One interesting thing is that Nat Turner, played by Nate Parker, who also directed the film, starts out as this preacher who's kind of complicit in the whole structure of oppression and slavery, and then ends up leading this rebellion. I mean, I just was thinking about it, just every single time there's, you know, a really good film or book about this type of, you know, this period of history, I'm reminded of, you know, being in high school and first really reading all of the details of it. You sort of knew that something horrible had happened, but when you get down to the details of it, it's just horrifying. I think there's something in our human nature that makes you want to pretend it didn't happen.
Periodically
or forget
about
that
that
it was as bad as it was. And, you know, the other thing that makes me sad, even just watching the trailer, is like, there's no happy ending. There's a long-term happy ending, you know, kind of, for our society. But, like, in this story, presumably,
Nat Turner was hanged for his efforts of this slave role. That's history, is not a spoiler.
Right.
But I did think it was, like, you know, evocative. Like, the tone of the trailer is really interesting. It uses Nina Simone's Strange Fruit, which is, you know, used often when talking about slavery. And, you know, there's, like, a shot of, like, a white girl kind of leading a black girl on a leash. Which is just like really, you know, it just kind of grabs you in a way, like that one image of dehumanization. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I kind of thought of the comparisons to Braveheart. It like doesn't have the epic battle scenes like that I think come up later in the film, but the idea of it being very personal and very vivid, and you know, having the director kind of very as the star kind of being very prominent in it. I don't know. Yeah. I like the trailer.
It's a really well cut trailer, and I won't say what exactly it is about it, but the trailer does unfortunately spoil, I think, the most effective artistic thing in the scene in the movie in a way. I'm not gonna say what it is, but so I was like I understand why they showed it or whatever, but I was a little surprised that they did.
Trailer but logic for
to,
you
to me yeah. It seems like, you know, it's a good next movie in a way about this topic, next big film, awardsy film after 12 Years a Slave, which was so arty and so kind of restrained, and here you got a little bit more venturing into a populist territory, but still unflinchingly showing this just absolutely shameful, terrifying episode.
No, it's it doesn't come out till October, so we have so long to keep talking about this movie. Is like, oh, what's that going to be like? But the trailer was kind of an interesting salvo, and it was, you know, coming at this point in the year when you're just about to gear up for summer movies. It's like, oh, but wait, just a couple months away, we've got this kind of stuff coming. So don't give up hope just yet with all the Batman v Supermans of the world.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Submit yourselves to your masters with all respect.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
So So now we'd like to welcome Kate Erbland, who is the film editor for IndieWire. And she and her colleagues have been tirelessly covering the Tribeca Film Festival, as they do every year. But Kate, this is your first year with IndieWire at Tribeca. Are you dead yet? How exhausted are you at this point?
I have no concept of time anymore. This year just seems like it's been particularly busy, but I think that's for everyone.
Everyone at IndieWire.
Everyone I've talked to. I've talked to publicists. I've talked to writers. Everyone's running around like a crazy person, but that's the festival.
Yeah. So we always, as New Yorkers, we always have kind of a tricky time covering Tribeca because it's like you could go to a movie or you could go home and feed your cat. And let's, and I think you literally have tweeted about feeling bad about leaving your cats at home while going to movies.
If I have a chance to go home and be with my cats, I think I'm going to do that. I mean, that's why it's easier. Like if you go to Sundance, you go to Toronto, you're just there.
Yeah.
And here you're actually also at home and regular work too. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little tricky.
So what is Tribeca kind of offering that? I mean, it's a lot of these movies don't have distributors and may, you know, emerge on, you know, obscure VOD platform, if not at all. But like, what's it offering that you guys are bringing to your readers? Like, what are people interested in learning about Tribeca from what you guys have been covering?
Well, one of the things that Tribeca is really interested in is female filmmakers, and they kind of always have been. This year, about a third of their slate is directed by female filmmakers, and they're really like...
Which is an insane percentage.
It's an insane percentage. So that's a really great part of the slate. And then also second features from emerging directors. Two of my favorite films at the festival are second features from filmmakers who have already been on the festival circuit and are sort of like more hitting their stride now.
Which are?
Mike Birbiglia's movie, Don't Think Twice, and Sofia Takal's movie, Always Shine.
Yeah, Mike Birbiglia had Sleepwalk with Me like 4 years ago. Yeah,
which was at Sundance.
Yeah, and he's a stand-up comedian. He's been on like This American Life and stuff,
yeah.
So people know who he is. So, I mean, are these, like, when you're writing about these movies or, like, covering them, like, are people like, why do I want to hear about this if I can't see this? Because we've had this problem, like, with Sundance, with Toronto, like, everything, these movies don't emerge for a while, and Tribeca sometimes has even smaller movies. Like, do you hear that, or is the IndieWire audience, like, plugged in enough to...
I mean, I think it's sort of 50-50. I think that our audience is looking for really independent films and films that have not been distributed yet, but it's always... really important to find like a little in and an angle that anyone can appreciate. Mm-hmm. Like I talked to Robert Schwartzman of the Schwartzman Coppolas, who directed a movie here called Dreamland. And we had a really great conversation. But my whole thing was, this is a guy who's Francis Ford Coppola's nephew, whose movie is not influenced by The Godfather. He's influenced by 80s sex comedies. So we had a really fun conversation about like Loverboy and Risky Business. And he's just like, yeah, my family's great. We're creators, but let's talk about Loverboy. So there's always something like that that you can find.
And Tribeca is also really big with documentaries, right? I mean, is there anything in particular in that realm that is standing out for you?
Well, the one documentary that I have not seen that everyone's talking about is All This Panic, which is directed by a female filmmaker.
Which I actually managed to see, one of like three Tribeca movies.
Yeah, that's the one that everyone seems to be talking about, and I really need to make some time for that one.
And what's that about?
It's about a group of teenagers growing up in Brooklyn, and the filmmaker followed them for about 2 years. She was their across-the-street neighbor. So I guess my understanding is they're really smart kids. I think they all go to like art school, but it's following them as they're growing up.
And it's filmed in this really beautiful way. It's this husband and wife filmmaking team. She's the director and he's the cinematographer, and they're photographers when they're not making movies. And it's just gorgeous. Like all the, you know, like close-ups and shallow focus and like use of light. And like, you know, some they'll be walking like on the beach in Coney Island, like a little more than you probably imagine the average Brooklyn teenager does, but it makes for very beautiful scenery.
Right.
But it's very evocative, like makes you feel these like teenage girl emotions, like almost in a way that a narrative film was, which makes it really interesting. But I don't know if it has a distributor yet, which is the... ongoing problem of talking about film festivals.
Well, and you know, we talk about the narratives that can come out of Toronto for us, for this group talking about awards. Yeah. Toronto's easy because it is all about like the beginning of Oscar season. And then Sundance is kind of, at least you say, all right, who's going to get a big, you know, deal? Who's going to get picked up for a lot of money? And can any of these pull off like a Little Miss Sunshine, Beast of the Southern Wild thing of at least making it to the finish line? Is there anything at Tribeca that could make it to the finish line, even in documentaries where I think people do think that that tends to be the strongest part of the festival?
I mean, not that I've seen yet. I haven't seen everything.
Well, the one thing that is a kind of a weird contender is the O.J. Simpson miniseries that's going to be on ESPN and actually is going to have an Oscar qualifying run, which seems complicated because it's like a 10-hour miniseries, but they're going to put it in theaters. It's going to work. And I've been hearing about this since Sundance. Kate, you've actually managed to see the whole thing.
I've managed to see the whole thing. It's incredible. It's like, you know, it's almost 10 hours. It's sort of loosely divided up into episodes, but it immediately just gets you so plunged into O.J. Simpson's life. And I'm someone who loved the FX show too, and I sort of watched them at the same time, and they pair together really amazingly.
You weren't over OJ'd.
Yeah, I was not over
OJ'd. How does it compare to the structure of the FX show?
Well, it's very similar. Well, because it starts actually right when he's going into college, so you get to know early OJ, and you see how the forces that sort of shaped his life before he became very famous, but sort of right before he became very famous. And then it actually continues all the way through until the present day. So the stuff in the trial is pretty much right in the middle.
Right.
So it's like, if you're not sure what OJ's been up to lately,
it goes into the Vegas trial.
It goes into the Vegas trial, the Vegas burglary, which is very complicated and confusing. And they even say, like, this is the clearest way we can break down this very weird thing that OJ did.
He went to go steal back his own memorabilia from somebody. He's convicted of it.
Yes.
Right?
There was other memorabilia there, and he's like, just take this memorabilia too. It was like Joe Montana stuff. And he's like, mine now. With like a group of friends who maybe had a gun, or at least said they had guns.
Oh boy.
Did anyone get into this idea that he might have that concussion disease? Because the guy that Will Smith, I'm bringing this back to Oscars.
Yeah.
The guy that Will Smith played in Concussion said he would bet his medical license that OJ had that.
CTE.
Yeah.
I don't think they
didn't come up 10 hours. They never mentioned that. Okay, just checking.
Yeah, I know that that's like something that people have been talking about, so I can't remember if that's something that's in the doc or if I'm just like randomly remembering that.
We have to ask Mike Ryan, who saw it 3 times. He'll know.
Yes, we can ask Mike Ryan. He'll tell you.
If it's, it'll be in the sequel. They're doing another 10 hours.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, clearly O.J. Simpson is the most fascinating American figure.
Evidently.
I just like imagining these Oscar voters like just getting a stack of screeners and sitting in their homes, their Neutra homes, trying to watch 10 hours of an OJ documentary. They might.
Maybe the strategy is if they get that screener first, they'll watch 10 hours of this documentary, so they'll be so documentary out that they won't watch the other nominees. And that'll just
I've learned enough this year.
Yeah, I'm done.
So Richard, you've seen a bunch of Tribeca stuff. Anything on your radar?
I've seen a couple interesting movies. One was Wolves, which is directed by Bart Freundlich, who is unfortunately better known as Julianne Moore's husband. Yeah. But he's been a filmmaker since the 90s. That's how they actually met on one of his first films, I think. And it's this movie about a kid in New York City who is a kind of star basketball player. He goes to St. Anthony's, a kind of made-up prep school. His name is Anthony. They call him St. Anthony. He's sort of the savior of this team. But he has a father at home, played by Michael Shannon, who is a compulsive gambler. And so these two kind of tensions mount, you know, on the basketball court and then at home. And it's a really, it's a beautifully filmed drama. The kid who did a few episodes of that show, American Crime, in a sort of supporting role this past season, he's great. Michael Shannon, as always, is really good.
Does Michael Shannon have like 8 movies coming out this year?
Yeah, he just doesn't
sleep. And he's on Broadway in Long Day's Journey.
God, that's true.
Yeah, he doesn't sleep, I don't think.
You know, it would be creepy enough to have Michael Shannon as your dad, but for him to also be a compulsive gambler really screw you
who
up.
Who drinks a lot, and the film makes a really compelling, creepy, you know, sort of point of showing that, like, the father is jealous of the son and sort of subtly sabotages him. It's an interesting movie. I think that it turns toward the end into sort of a surprisingly straightforward, uplifting sports drama, which isn't exactly my wheelhouse.
Yeah. Is it like win-win-esque?
It's not. It's more dramatic than that. Okay. Win-win, which is that great Tom McCarthy movie, is sort of, that's a little more low to the ground. This has soaring music and big cheers at the end. There are a couple problems. There's a sort of magical black character who sort of gives wise counsel to the boy.
Problematic.
Yeah, that's a little bit like, ugh. But
we need like a problematic sound effect here.
Yeah.
We have so endless opportunities for it. Yeah.
And I don't know if it technically, it's at Tribeca, but it's also out this week. I saw Elvis versus Nixon.
Dawn of Justice.
Dawn of Justice. Elvis and Nixon. And, you know, I think a lot of people, another Michael Shannon film. I'm only seeing Michael Shannon movies these days.
That's easy to do.
Yeah, Loving will be at Cannes in a few weeks. You really have plenty to do.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I really liked it. I think that people are sort of ragging on that movie for being kind of shallow because it's about this famous photograph of Elvis in the Oval Office with Nixon. And obviously there is a big story to be told, and especially given what that administration was like and who worked for that administration. And this movie gives them a very soft pedal. These two sort of aides to Nixon who, you find out in title cards at the end of the movie, both went to prison for Watergate, are played by Colin Hanks and Evan Peters from American Horror Story, who everyone loves, and they're really cute and charming. And and Kevin Spacey as Nixon is like kind of like avuncular and sort of goofy, and it's like this nice little light movie.
Is there stuff about drugs and guns and things?
Well, so basically, you know, there's a lot of stuff about guns because Elvis loves his guns.
Didn't Elvis bring a gun to the White House and they let him bring his gigantic
several
gun?
Several guns and a gift gun in a glass case for Nixon.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, Elvis is ostensibly there to become an undercover agent to expose drug use, you know, drug
at a time when he was wasted on drugs.
I mean, and the
that's
movie
not in there?
No, really. No.
Okay, just checking.
Anyway, so I like that. You know, that was a nice movie.
And that's out in theaters this Friday.
Yeah.
I think on VO or it's an Amazon release. So it's, it should be widely available at some point.
So I have seen some good Tribeca stuff. And I feel like this year, I don't know if you agree, Kate, more than others, seems a little bit more stacked in the narrative category than it has been. Like, I mean, maybe I'm just looking at that cheaply in terms of celebrity names involved or whatever, but do you feel any difference about Tribeca this year in particular in that way? Or,
well, I mean, Tribeca's always had good star, well, not good star vehicles, but star vehicles. Mm-hmm. I think this year the quality is a little bit higher. I feel like I haven't seen anything that I've been like, oh my God, who made this movie? Everything has been pretty good and solid. Another movie that's at Tribeca that's also out this week that I know Richard and I both really like a lot is The Meddler, which was also at Toronto, which is just, it's not what I think people think it is. Like, Susan Sarandon plays a meddling mom, but it's really charming, and it's like, definitely, she's the lead role. This is not something where it's like a two-hander with her and Rose Byrne. Rose Byrne's amazing in it, but it's Susan Sarandon's movie.
So this isn't The Guilt Trip, the sequel?
No.
I don't think we needed that.
No one asked for that. Yeah, so that's another really good one that I think might surprise some people later.
I agree. I would urge everyone to go see that.
Yeah, you've been talking to the cast of The Meddler like all week at various events.
Yep,
so.
Well, after this goes up, but I will have hosted a Q&A at the Apple Store in Soho.
And an interview that you did with them will be on VF.com at some point this week.
Yes,
so,
that's right.
Yeah.
So
my operating theory about Tribeca this year, and Kate, you've been going to a lot of this stuff, so maybe you can bear me out, is that I feel like the events and the talks and the panels and what they're able to get from people is almost eclipsing the films at this point. It's obviously still a film festival, but like, I went to an event yesterday where it was J.J. Abrams talking to Chris Rock. There's Jodie Foster's doing a panel. Tina Fey's doing a panel. They're able to get in these people who don't necessarily have a film that they want to have in the festival. Like, Jodie Foster's doing a talk. Her film Money Monster is going to Cannes. It's not going to Tribeca, but she's here to do a talk. Is that, I mean, is Tribeca leaning more into that, or am I just more interested in it?
No, I mean, I think over the past couple of years, their talks have been especially, like, fantastic. Like, you know, J.J. Abrams doesn't have anything to promote here, but he's here, and he had a fantastic talk with Chris Rock.
Yeah, they just liked talking to each other.
Well,
and
the problem for Tribeca is, among other things, it's the timing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So basically, if you didn't get into Sundance, and you know you're not, you have no chance of getting into Cannes, you submit to Tribeca.
Yeah.
And so they can do a lot of stuff because they're in New York, they have Robert De Niro, and, you know, able to presumably make 3 phone calls a year or whatever it is. they have a lot of smart people involved. But they just have a really hard problem of getting good films.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, and anytime you see a film with a big star in it, like, odds are it's definitely tried to go to Sundance and couldn't make it in there, or South By for that matter. And, you know, we'll get holdovers from other festivals, like from South By or like The Meddler coming from Toronto. But yeah, like, original films premiering, unless they're very small, like Always Shine, the Sofia Tikal movie that Kate and I both saw, which is very low key under the radar. Like, you could definitely have seen it at Sundance, but it has a good home at Tribeca too. But then you look at a whole list of movies made by people you've never heard of, starring people you've never heard of, and it's like, well, how am I going to choose how to see this?
But I think that, you know, because to me, frankly, I do think Tribeca needs to continue the soul searching and figure out why it exists. And but I think what you said about female filmmakers, it would be a great thing for them to just lean into, to borrow a phrase.
Yeah, and I think that they're really leaning into it, and I think they're continuing to do so. And I think that's something that could really, you know, there's a lot of sort of female directed film festivals, but to have like a large scale film festival that really digs into this as like an added bonus, I think is something that they could do a fantastic
I think it's
job.
A better strategy than leaning into the vaxxer thing, personally.
Did you see? You didn't see Vax, did you?
I did not see Vax.
Yeah, that was...
I mean, you almost had a more in the controversy, like, because they pulled the movie before,
know.
You know, and I was like, just go with it, man. Yeah. Just, like, have it be crazy.
Yeah, this was a documentary made by the guy who published the paper that said that linked vaccines to autism.
Who's been like discredited and I think can't practice medicine in Great Britain anymore. Like,
And it was programmed for like a one screening and a conversation. And Robert De Niro kind of came out saying like, I just want everyone to know what all the possible causes of autism are. And people went crazy. Rightly, I think. I think that movie has no place in a film festival. But they pulled it. But no, you're right. They should have really just like the protests would have been amazing.
Because they got so much press for the festival. And, you know, and people were mad, I guess. So it wasn't necessarily positive press, but, you know, all PR is good. You know, so it just, I don't know. I was kind of like, just screen it the one time and, you know.
The movie came out. Like, it's at the Angelica right now. Mm-hmm. And supposedly it's going to have like a national release.
Wow.
So I think it's pretty good for Vaxxed. Maybe not so great for Tribeca. Great for Vaxxed.
Yeah. God, box office suites are just flourishing. On the female filmmaker thing that you were talking about, Mike, also, like, even in the television programming they're doing, they're leaning into that. Like, they had a Broad City panel over the weekend. Kate's going to this event where Samantha Bee is going to be a keynote speaker. And, you know, she's not promoting a movie, like we were saying, but she's there to participate in it. So it's definitely, like, that's a really good niche for it. Like, they're doing a lot of virtual reality stuff that's really interesting. There's a lot, I mean, it's such a huge festival.
Yeah,
there's
I want to
so
go to that virtual reality room.
I want to see Oculus Rift at some
point. It's like right across the street from us, isn't it? Let's just go. Let's just carve out a little time.
Just barge in and say, flash our badges and say, show us your virtual reality.
Bring us your Oculus.
Yeah. So there's all these different prongs of it. So, I mean, are we kind of missing the boat by just talking about narrative films that might get Oscar buzz?
Well, I mean, I know even Robert De Niro's like sort of said, you know, it's still a film festival. Like, mm-hmm. this is a film festival. And I think that as stuff like virtual reality becomes more prevalent, like even at Sundance, Sundance has always really leaned into virtual reality with New Frontiers. They kind of have to do it. And I think they're doing a pretty good job with it. They seem to really enjoy the virtual reality stuff. Even the closing night film isn't really a film. It's like more a multimedia experience. Mm-hmm. But I think that 15 years in, like, they really are still trying to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
While still saying we're a film festival.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another thing to not totally overlook is Andrew Essex, who's a very nice, smart guy, who is the new head of Tribeca, is a branded content guy. He's an old magazine guy who then started, or I guess was a head of a company called Droga 5. And I think that Andrew sees a like branded content future for Tribeca, if you can imagine. You know, so getting all kinds of cool creators involved, even if they don't have a film, but they come do a talk or they make a virtual reality thing or whatever, serves this larger purpose of like, can this have even like a profitable life as a branded content studio?
Yeah, I mean, 15 years is young for a film festival in some ways. Like, Sundance was around for, I think, almost that long before Sex, Lies, and Videotape really gave it an identity. So the future is still, you know, big for Tribeca. And it's releasing films under its banner. It's got year-round programming. There's a lot going on Tribeca-wise beyond just this one film
festival. And cynically speaking, I mean, you know, you just, if you go to any of the screenings that aren't P&I's, press and industry screenings, you know, that have commercials before the movie starts, like, and you go to the lounges or whatever, I mean, they have a lot of, you know, brands interested in being a part of the festival, which is like good for their bottom line, obviously. So clearly there is a sort of an interest from filmmakers, from, you know, people just coming for talks, from brands, whatever. Like, they obviously have all the material there. It just, you know, just shaping it into.
It just seems like it needs a headline of what, why is this here? You know, I think like South by Southwest just recently sort of figured that out.
Well, they're kind of doing the tech angle of it at South by, which is, you know, it's adjacent to the film in some way, but that's like what's made South by famous.
Well, and also like the midnight movies.
No? Yeah, the midnight movies too. Yeah. Well, and the other thing about going to screenings, Richard, is like they're crowded. Like, people come to these movies. Like, it's not just us, like, jaded people with our press badges. Like, if you live in New York City and you want to, like, get a crash course in, like, indie filmmakers, like, it's a pretty accessible way to do it.
And not to pit them against each other, I don't know if you agree with this, Kate, but, like, I've noticed that the audiences at the Tribeca Film Festival seem to be a little bit more diverse, a little younger in some cases, than the audience, say, at the New York Film Festival, which sort of up at Lincoln Center, which seems to trend very a particular Upper West Side demographic.
People who live within 10 blocks of Lincoln Center.
I think with New York Film Festival, you get a lot of film society types who, you know, spend a lot of their time up there at Lincoln Center anyway with films. Yeah, I mean, I've been to a bunch of public screenings. I've been to one press and industry screening, and they've been filled with people, and it's been a really wide range of demographics. And I'm also, like, I go to a lot of regional festivals too, and usually those are older skewing audiences who don't really know what they're getting into, and I don't get that feeling at Tribeca at all. Like, I feel like people are here, they're excited, they have at least some sense of what they're about to see, which you don't always get at festivals.
Do you have any regional festivals coming up? Is there anything we should be aware of?
I'm actually going to be on a jury for the Nantucket Film Festival, which is at the end of June.
I've heard that's a nice one.
Yeah, they do a lot of like comedy panels there and stuff.
They actually just released their film program yesterday, which is like has got a bunch of good stuff. All This Panic is there. Mm. So if I don't see All This Panic here, I'm going to see it in Nantucket. So that should be a pretty good
one. So you're going to be in Nantucket at the end of June for a week?
Yeah. Well, for like 4 days.
That sounds awful.
Still, that's I pity you.
Really rough.
Are you obliged to not see All This Panic so that you can watch it fresh with the other jurors? Or is it in competition?
I'm actually on a jury for, they have a writer's lab for episodic television.
Oh, cool.
So I'm actually reading scripts and then approving scripts to go to this writer's colony. So then I get to go to the festival and kind of hang out and my work is pretty much done.
Wow.
That's amazing.
I know. Yeah.
You're going to eat really, really well for like 4 days. Yeah.
So if you want to know how to get to that point in your career, email Kate Herbold and she'll tell you.
Yeah.
Well, Kate, thank you for giving us the lowdown on Tribeca. If anything comes up that you love, people can follow you on Twitter at Kate Herbold. But with only one E between. Caterbland.
Caterbland.
Yeah. Or check anywire.com where all the Tribeca coverage is. So I think it was my bright idea for all of us to see The Huntsman: Winter's War, because I've been so intrigued by it just because it's got Charlize Theron and Jessica Chastain in it, who have been Oscar nominees, plus Emily Blunt and Chris Hemsworth. Chris Hemsworth reprising his role from Snow White and The Huntsman, to which this movie is both a prequel and a sequel, which I did not know when I went in to see it. One of the many surprises that awaited us in The Huntsman: Winter's War. Mike, after we saw this movie, I apologize to you for making you see this.
And then I read Richard's review where I just felt terrible because I was one of the people scoff laughing. Although I did it very quietly, unlike Matt Patch's previous guest who was very loudly scoff laughing right next
to
me.
There was a lot of loud scoff laughing.
I will say, in defense of the scoff laughers, which Richard singled out as the most unpleasant sound in mankind, you do have to kind of find a way to enjoy your 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like, it's got to be like you're a human sitting through something. But it wasn't the worst thing. Richard liked it.
No, I mean, I think that what I was maybe inexactly taking to task was not the laughter at the movie. It's more, there are certain strains of that laughter, and it really happens a lot during critic screenings, that are very like telegraphing. They're like, I mean, I get it, silly. You guys know that I think it's stupid. And it's very like drawing attention to yourself in this way. And I only heard a few of those particular laughs during
all of them
Winter's
from Matt
War.
All, right between Katie. So
this movie is advertised as basically Clash of the Titans between Charlize Theron and Emily Blunt as these like beautiful queens who have these mystical powers. It's a lot less of that than I think it's being advertised as, which is one of the things that let me down about it. But Richard, it seemed like for you there was enough of that that it worked for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think the strengths of the movie are, one, that there is a pretty good gender balance on hand. I mean, you know, we have Jessica Chastain, Charlize Theron, Emily Blunt, a couple other actresses playing dwarves very, very charmingly, compared to, you know, three male leads. So that's a good, you know, that's a nice change. So I like that aspect of it. And I like, in particular, you know, in their limited scenes together, Theron and Blunt just really just tearing things down. I mean, they're just
chewing
like
scenery.
They're just chewing scenery left
it's
and right and
masticating.
Like, yeah, it's
and
beyond
it's
scenery
fun
chewing.
To watch, you know, because a lot of these kind of big, overwrought special effects, fantasy, whatever, adventure, action movies, that when it gets to these kind of climactic showdowns, it's between men or at most one woman and a man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And here it's not exactly. It's and I think that like that's kind of fun. And I am, you know, maybe partial toward Emily Blunt and Charlize Theron as actors. They're, you know, two people I will kind of always go see in things. And so it's fun to watch them kind of tear around. And then there's Jessica Chastain doing all kinds of crazy action stuff.
And a crazy accent on top of that.
Oh, she's doing a wild, weird Jon Snow meets, I don't know what accent.
Okay, we got to pause for a quick second. In principle, I agree with you. I like the fact that it's basically a female-driven action movie.
Yeah.
It's an action movie for women or girls. It is. There are so many things that they rip off from Game of Thrones. What's up with that?
Yeah.
Like it's basically
and Frozen.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's basically Jon Snow and
Cersei.
Well, and Cersei and Rose Leslie.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Because Jessica Chastain.
Jessica Chastain.
Is
I mean, literally same hair color.
Yeah.
And then the warging thing. Like, did you think about that? Oh, Charlize Theron
sees
through the eyes of a bird. That's a Game of Thrones thing. Yeah. All the stuff about the North and like...
There's several ice walls that are built.
Ice walls.
Yeah.
It's fine. It just felt like somebody was like watching or either watching Game of Thrones being like, I could do this, or... More likely, some studio person was like, make it like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, come
back when it's more like Game of Thrones.
Give me Game of Thrones.
Winter's huge now.
People love winter.
We gotta do winter.
It's coming.
Game of Thrones plus Frozen. Like, you can't, like, ice. Everybody wants ice.
Yeah, I mean, and her Emily Blunt is hairstyled and costumed to look almost exactly like Elsa in Frozen.
Yeah, it's wild.
Also, another occasion for the problematic sound effect.
Yeah.
Rob Brydon, amazing comedian from The Trip, as a dwarf. I found that. Was that weird? Is that problematic?
Well, the first movie had all seven dwarves, most of them played by famous actors. Okay, like Nick Frost was returning from the first movie. Bob Hoskins was in there. Ian McShane was a dwarf.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it's basically what they did in The Hobbit.
I think it's still,
dwarves exist. But I guess Snow White is kind of grandfathered in. Like, this, they've been ridiculing dwarves for years, for centuries.
It's tricky.
But I haven't seen the Disney cartoon in ages. Like, does the cartoon make fun of how they look all the time? I mean, that's the thing. That's a very glaring bad thing in these two Huntsman movies.
Have you ever seen a female dwarf? And I know it was all. It's
and then
fine.
The female dwarves are saying that the men are really ugly. It's just a lot of like
it's just problematic.
Shaming.
Sam, we need like a aruga, a whistle,
like a siren. Yeah. So yes, you're right. Look, I mean, I think that in the review that I wrote, where I essentially was saying I liked it, I pointed out a lot of things that are not good about it.
Best thing about your review, many great things about your review. Best thing I think was with all due respect to all the amazing women. But I love what you said about Chris Hemsworth. Like, we should be happy that we have a movie star this.
Yeah, I think he's a rare commodity, a sort of rare element. He has, you know, he's obviously like really handsome and hunky and can do action, but there's something else there that we haven't quite seen teased out yet that I think I said in the review reminds me of a young Brad Pitt, where he was kind of this hunk who was sort of cast in certain roles, and then slowly people figured out that he was actually kind of a character actor. And I think that Hemsworth has gotten a few opportunities to do, you know, he was a kind of comic relief in Vacation last summer. This summer he's going to be that same, he's playing the Annie Potts role in Ghostbusters, right? As the kind of a secretary. So I'm glad he's getting these little opportunities. But I, you know, part of me is like, well, let's not blow out this flame. Like, let's foster it. Yeah. And, you know, because I'm just curious to see if he could be the heir apparent to a certain kind of fame, you know, a certain movie star, in the way that Channing Tatum has taken the mantle from, I don't know who, Bruce Willis? Like, I don't know.
Yeah,
who
I think Chris Hemsworth and Channing Tatum are kind of crowding each other. Or Channing Tatum is crowding out Chris Hemsworth in some way, but Chris Hemsworth's got Marvel. He's fine. I do think he's not getting the opportunities that the way that, like, Brad Pitt got 12 Monkeys, and we're like, oh, that's what he can do.
He's almost so big.
I know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and I think that, I bet you there was a thing in his contract where he didn't have to take his shirt off in this movie. They even made a joke where the female dwarf was like, I'd like for you to take your shirt off. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But, in the Brad Pitt comparison, he's more effortlessly charismatic and charming. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I feel like there's Brad Pitt is obviously a great actor, but you always feel like he's trying a little bit and not Hemsworth.
Yeah, no, like I think easy. So. Well, I think, you know, I think Brad Pitt he's a little weird. Like, he's kind of a quirky guy. Mm-hmm. And I think that Hemsworth, everything I've seen with him in interviews, he's just this kind of like good time, you know, guy from Australia. He's got, three kids now? He's my age. And, you know, he's just, I think he's sort of more like a sort of steady kind of middle of the road kind of guy. But I don't think that precludes him from being, he's effortlessly sort of charming and appealing. And I don't think that I'm fully just being biased about that because he's handsome. But
he was one of the pleasant surprises of the first movie, where you're kind of like, oh God, what are we in for? And and Kristen Stewart had this really nice like platonic rapport, and it made you kind of want to watch another movie about the Huntsman.
And he's actually acting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and yes, the accent might be a little wobbly and the lines
might be a
little
hokey, should have spent more on the accent advisor, because even Jessica Chastain was a little...
I just don't get why they had to be Scottish.
Why?
Scottish accents are so hard.
Were they Scottish or were they Yorkshire? Were they North Irish? I mean, it was really not...
I'm no expert.
Yeah.
Well, so can you guys explain to me why Kristen Stewart isn't in this movie?
Well, there's the personal reason, which is that she was having an affair with the director of the first
of the
movie,
one,
but he's not involved in this either. It's unclear to me how much that played a role in this. My guess is that the contract she signed had the option for a sequel and made her really expensive, and they were like, actually, we don't need Charlize Theron and Chris Hemsworth are what everyone liked from the first one. We can get rid of you. I have no idea how acrimonious it was, how happy she was to just go make Olivia Assayas movies instead. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when that whole thing broke with her and Rupert Sanders, I think that the language then was, they're going to distance her from the second film. They're not going to, you know, she's not going to be in it. And Sanders, I think, was originally going to direct it and then wasn't. And
I see.
You know, so this whole thing. But I think that, honestly, I think the real story is closer to what you said, Katie, that there was probably just some boring contract thing and she didn't want to do it, or, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that her story had sort of reached its...
It's true.
Conclusion or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have loved to see her. I thought that was a fascinating thing to have her in a big sort of action movie like that, not kind of, you know, as this kind of sword wielding heroine. But
I think this movie is cheaper than the first one too, and doesn't have those huge battle
scenes. It cost
scenes.
About $65 million less to make.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia.
Lord knows they paid Charlize Theron a bucket of money to come back for like four scenes in this movie, but it's worth it. You know, she was a blast in the first movie. She's a blast in this one. I think Emily Blunt is a little underserved because she has to be kind of under the thumb of Charlize Theron
and she's like frozen, cold, passive—not passive, but you know, she's withdrawn.
But it's it's worth the money they spent to like get Charlize Theron in that like gold eyeshadow and
totally
melting mirror.
So do we think there's a costumes nomination possibility here?
You never know.
They are pretty great costumes.
Yeah, no, they're
the makeup, that gold flake. Is that makeup or a costume?
I don't know.
I don't even know. Or CGI, who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, Charlize Theron's costumes are spectacular, and like, you know, a costume nomination on the power of one character's costumes is not impossible. So
And Blunt's are good too.
The one in the very last scene when Charlize and Emily Blunt are in the same room, I feel like Emily Blunt's costume looks incredibly cheap, and it's like they ran out of money and like had to give it all to Charlize's costumes, and we're just like, oh, here, Emily, you can have this shiny silver fabric.
There's also the problem is that if Emily Blunt's costumes are nominated, they'd have to nominate the frozen person again.
That's true, I know.
Oh, a minute, Sam, one more thing for the problematic whistle. The goblins, super deeply problematic, very problematic.
I kind of like, so they're basically like horned gorillas.
Wearing gold chains.
I hadn't even thought about that. Well, goblins are famously, you know, hoarders of gold in,
Right, well, I mean, because you could go either one way. It's either one stereotype or the way that, you know, people have criticized the goblins in Harry Potter.
As being like Jewish stereotypes.
Who are all bankers and have big noses, you know.
It was on a par with that.
These are
Sam is rippling a whistle.
Let's back out of that.
I will accept all pitches for non-problematic goblin presentation in movies. But I never heard of me on either racial stereotype, but you guys are very correct that either way you go, it's problematic. So someone needs to figure out how to do goblins.
I guess English people made this movie. They're just not as attuned as we Americans.
Right.
Yeah, they're not as terrified of offending people.
Yeah, they're just like, that'll be fun.
My guess is not enough people will see this movie for anyone to be that offended by the goblins. So we might not have to worry about
it. Sounds good.
If you like Charlize Theron chewing scenery.
Yeah.
You have to wait. She's in the beginning, and then she doesn't show up a while until the end.
And I think I've issued this caveat before. I saw this for free, so I'm not saying necessarily spend $100 to take your family to go see it this weekend.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you shouldn't, but
Jungle Book is probably more.
I'm just saying, like, if you maybe wanted to watch it some rainy Sunday when it comes on TV, that might be the most optimal way to see it.
Yeah, but, watch it the way that I watched the Divergent movie, where it's like, oh, this is on, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Madam Dwarf, we have no quarrel with you.
We seek a mirror.
I don't got no mirror.
Oh, that's clear.
Right. Oh, you are. Get
you. No, enough. What, tell us what you want.
Well, personally, I'd like you to take your shirt off and prance around for me.
And now we'll close with a chance to rewrite recent history. It has been 10 years since the Best Picture win that shocked the world, and I don't think we've ever really discussed it on this podcast. So if you were in charge of the 2006 Oscars, which is the one where Crash beat Brokeback Mountain, guys, what would have won Best Picture? And as a reminder, I'll go through the nominees. Crash won, and it beat up Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Good Night and Good Luck, and Munich.
That's a good year.
Yeah, it is a good year.
We were talking a couple episodes ago about the year with Black Swan and Social Network and how that was a great year. This was a good one, too.
Yeah, and just the five, too.
And I think the one that won was the outlier there.
Yeah.
In terms of being
the good movie split the vote.
Yeah, well, that yeah, and, exactly. And, the one that solved racism one that snuck on in.
And was about people in L.A.
Yeah.
Do we notice a theme here?
Yeah.
What wins Best Picture?
Well, I mean, it was what made that such a wild year is that Brokeback Mountain was just such the prohibitive favorite. Like, it had all these critics awards, and it was this historical movie. I mean, you look at it now, and, like, if that were to happen, I think, even, you know, we've come so far in gay rights, even just since 2006, that if that were to happen now, it would be an even bigger outrage. It was a pretty big outrage at the time.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had just graduated from college when that movie came out. It was like, I'd graduated in 05 and movie mm-hmm. came out at the end of that year and I was pretty young, and I went to go see it, and I just became so obsessed with Brokeback Mountain. Like, I had the download of the soundtrack and just listened to it on repeat. My roommates at the time wanted to kill me because it was just this, like, sad guitar music emanating from my room at all times. So I was really gutted when it didn't win, and
yeah.
I was mad. You know, it felt like the, you know, I think the gay marriage debate was really heating up. I think that it was around the time that Massachusetts passed. It was the first.
Yeah, well, and what's crazy is Proposition 8 was 2 years later.
That's right.
It feels like they happened a million years apart.
And I was living in Boston at the time, so it all felt very timely. But now, 10 years later, now that we've, you know, solved every gay problem there was to solve.
Totally.
I don't know. I think that I might be a little bit more, I wouldn't give it to Crash,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I think there could be definitely an argument to be made for Capote, which is a movie that I keep coming back to in a way that I haven't really come back to Brokeback Mountain as much, just because it's such a rich, textured, beautifully performed, subtly written movie that, you know, is small in scale, and I think that's why it probably never really stood a chance.
I haven't seen Capote since 2005. And
oh, it's really great.
I never thought to revisit it for anything but the performance. And that and Good Night and Good Luck were both these kind of, like, small character studies. I mean, Good Night mm-hmm. and Good Luck had a pretty good ensemble cast. And then you got Munich, which is this very large, sprawling revenge story that I saw for the first time a couple of years ago and was really blown away by. Like, and it's so Bush era 2005, kind of about, like, getting revenge and going after your enemies and, like, you know, if you're not with us, you're against us, and, you know, figuring out the meaning of your country. The last shot of the movie is on the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
So it's got, like, it has such a timeliness to it that I think is really powerful, even more in retrospect.
Yeah, and I think that Munich also admirably flirted with some really conflicted politics. You know, Steven Spielberg had, you know, 13 years prior made Schindler's List, and he is, you know, active in, you know, Holocaust remembrance and Jewish identity kind of things. And so this movie about, you know, Mossad agents going on this kind of revenge spree calls into question a lot of Israeli politics, and but also doesn't, you know, so it's an interesting movie. And I think that trickiness maybe didn't help it. And I think also there's the kind of infamous sex scene intercut with the massacre scene at the end of Munich that I think really hobbled that movie. And, like, every review I read of that movie, I remember when it came out, was like, and then there's this, like, really misjudged sex scene at the end.
Yeah.
Pulled the problematic whistle.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Exactly. Yeah.
Mike, where do you think you come down?
I think Brokeback still. I mean, I remember I saw all these movies at the time I was working at Vanity Fair. I was observing this. You know, the Crash thing was kind of shocking. It's funny, though, because all the things you want to say about how Hollywood might have problems with a gay story or something sort of disintegrate when you're like, but they gave Ang Lee, the director,
right,
thing anyway. So it had to be something else. I think it's just the usual narcissism of, like, that looks like my life, I'm going to vote for
mm-hmm.
it. But that is, to me, the worst of the Oscars is when it gets provincial. And mm-hmm. and to me, the movie that was the sensation that really commented on our times in an incredibly important way, in a big sweeping way on screen, was Brokeback Mountain, even if I don't necessarily want to go watch it tonight, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because, Richard, I was thinking, oh, maybe you like Capote now because Philip Seymour Hoffman died, but of course Heath Ledger died too. Like, we've lost.
Yeah.
It's funny, in 10 years, we've lost both of those guys.
Yeah.
Two of the most brilliant actors, I think, of their generation.
Yeah.
But I would stick with, you know, Good Night and Good Luck, we haven't talked about much. To me, it's less, I like it less in retrospect because it's the beginning of, like, George Clooney's semi-irritating finger wagging at the press.
Well, he won the supporting actor prize that year as kind of for Syriana, and he was nominated for Good Night and Good Luck that same night.
Yeah.
And he kind of did that finger wagging thing about people say we're out of touch. And
He literally got up to accept his Oscar for Syriana and says, well, I guess I'm not winning director, like recognizing that he kind of got the Syriana best.
Yeah.
Which is, when you think about George Clooney's Oscar being for best supporting actor, it makes no sense at all. It's so weird.
Right. Yeah. I think it's just a little, his stuff is a little pat. you know, that film feels a little pat. Capote is much more kind of, yeah, intriguing and mysterious, but also maybe not as fully formed as a culture-defining thing as Brokeback was. Brokeback yeah. just was like, it was an absolute phenomenon, and it did break boundaries. I mean, mm-hmm. for Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal to go there in that way, that kind of like almost violent but weirdly sexy even as a straight guy way, was like, that was a crazy thing that happened. It's like probably made people uncomfortable. I mean, it made a lot of people uncomfortable.
It's a really deep connection to watch between two people that's kind of uncomfortable to watch anyone do that on screen, where it's like, oh, should I be seeing this? It's like they really went to this place together, which is, you know, makes a really powerful film. And look, I mean, that cast, like those two, Anne Hathaway, Michelle Williams, Kate Mara in a tiny role.
I was
going to
say, it launched a lot of serious acting careers.
Yeah.
I mean, or redefined some careers in Hathaway and Michelle Williams in particular, but also Heath Ledger. I feel like that was a huge breakthrough for him, for mm-hmm. Gyllenhaal even, maybe. Yeah, I think that, you know, if to put myself in a voter's head about Brokeback, maybe it's one of the reasons I haven't watched it a ton since it came out, is, you know, it's a pretty episodic sort of plotting movie. There's sort of an inevitable tragedy that we're moving toward.
Yeah, it takes place over like 20 years.
Yeah, and I think that it doesn't have a sense of, there's really no hope. At the end, there's no, you know, there's no redemption really to be found.
No, it's devastating.
It's devastating, which, you know, can catch the fancy of Academy voters sometimes. But I think that, you know, for the right kind of or the wrong kind of voter, that movie could seem a lot like Vegetables. You know, like, oh, yes. I gotta watch this sad gay thing now. You know,
if this same slate of five movies came up this year for the Oscar, do you think it would go the same way? Do you think Brokeback would?
No, I think people would think that Brokeback was problematic because it was straight actors or whatever. Honestly,
oh right,
I honestly do. I think that
or like a rural America thing. Like this is what you think people in Wyoming are
absolutely.
Doing.
I think that I mean, who's to say? It would still be a beautifully made movie, a beautifully acted movie. But I think that any little kind of tingles of like, oh, that's a little, I wish maybe they could have found like gays, actors, whatever, like, that we had 10 years ago, now what I think would be magnified.
You're 100% yeah. right about
but,
that. Although
know,
I don't know that it would have prevented it from winning.
Eddie Redmayne got nominated for Danish Girl,
yeah.
so.
Yes.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess my vote has to go to Brokeback in the end, like just for the historical importance of it and, you know.
Well, no matter how we vote, Crash still wins. So
I know. No, remember we decided last week that we gave Richard Linklater
oh, that's
an Oscar,
right.
so
that's
we've
right.
solved this.
Yeah, we're retconning.
Yeah, well done, everybody. We've fixed history.
And finally, I would say that, you know, we are a little bit out of touch in Hollywood every once in a while. I think it's probably a good thing. We're the ones who talk about AIDS when it was just being whispered. And we talked about civil rights when it wasn't really popular. And we, you know, we bring up subjects. We were the ones, this academy, this group of people gave Hattie McDaniel an Oscar in 1939 when blacks were still sitting in the backs of theaters. I'm proud to be a part of this academy. Proud to be part of this community. I'm proud to be out of touch. And I thank you so much for this.
So that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate us and review us on iTunes. We really appreciate it, and it helps us find listeners in this off-season, which hopefully we've proved by now is still pretty interesting, even if the Oscar race is a few months away. You can find us all on vanityfair.com, and we're all on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard?
Rylaws, RILAWS.
And we're all at Little Gold Men on Twitter. This episode was produced by Sam Dingman and edited by Tim Einenkel, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the best truth bomb about real life in your 30s goes to Kate Erbland.
If I have a chance to go home and be with my cats, I think I'm going to do that.